And both recorders are on. So today is July 10th, 2014, and we are going to start with a little intro reading and then get started. My name is Kelsey Bobble, research assistant and master's student at IUPUI. I have the privilege to be interviewing Ms. Marty Lamar in a conference room in Kavanaugh Hall on the IUPUI campus. This interview is the second for Ms. Lamar. The first was on July 3rd, 2014, and both are part of a larger oral history project titled Voices from Indianapolis Waterways. The purpose of this project is to better understand the changing role of waterways such as the White River, Pleasant Run, Fall Creek, Pogues Run, and Eagle Creek in Indianapolis. Excerpts of some of these interviews may also be used as part of a public art installation by Mary Miss, a New York City-based artist. Principal investigators for this project are Philip Scarpino, Director of Public History at IUPUI, and Jason Kelly, Director of IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute. Funding comes from the IUPUI Chancellor's Office, the Arts and Humanities Institute, and the Public History Program. We are interviewing Ms. Lamar because she is a longtime resident of a neighborhood near Pleasant Run and because she is president of the We Can Neighborhood Association on the southeast side of Indianapolis near Pleasant Run. We Can stands for West East of Churchman Avenue Neighbors. Also in the room are two students working on this project. Elena Ripple is a master's student enrolled in IUPUI's public history program. Lynette Taylor is an undergraduate who has experience working with the Arts and Humanities Institute and the Rivers of the Anthropocene project organized by Philip Scarpino and Jason Kelly, as well as Dr. Scarpino, professor at IUPUI. Elena, Lynette, and I will be taking turns interviewing Ms. Lamar during this session. Today, we will be focusing on Marty's personal experience, her involvement with We Can, the Coke plant near Pleasant Run Waterway, environmental justice, resources available to her neighborhood, and continual renewal plans for the future. Pleasant Run flows about 27 miles through east and southeast Indianapolis. Pleasant Run Waterway is largely underground from 38th, passing through a series of parks: Pleasant Run Golf Course, Ellenberg Park, Burger Park, Christian Park, and Garfield Park. Pleasant Run Creek enters the White River near the southwest side of the city, just beyond where it crosses under Bluff Road. For much of its journey through Indianapolis, Pleasant Run flows between Pleasant Run Parkway North Drive and Pleasant Run Parkway South Drive, usually with the creek and some green space bracketed between the two parkways. These parkways are part of the Indianapolis Park and Boulevard system, which is a product of a comprehensive plan developed by landscape architect George Edward Kessler between 1908 and 1915. Kessler's plan envisioned parkways following the four major watercourses in the city: White River, Fall Creek, Pleasant Run, and Pogues Run. Ms. Lamar, I would like to ask your permission to do the following. Record the interview, deposit the interview in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives and Arts and Humanities Institute for the use of their patrons, including possible posting of this interview or parts of this interview to their website, and use parts of the recording in the public art project being carried out by Mary Miss concerning the Indianapolis waterways. Do we have your permission to do these things?
Yes, I, Marty Lamar, give you permission.
Wonderful, let's get started. I would like to begin our second session by following up something we talked about last time. At the end of our first interview, after we turned off the recorders, you showed us a picture of your home taken in the early 1990s. You lived in what had once been a substantial Queen Anne type home, but in the photo you showed us, the windows were boarded up and there wasn't much landscape. So why in the early 1990s did you have the windows of your home boarded up?
Prior to that, it was cut up into apartments and things like that, and big, huge windows. So, you know, it just wasn't in very good shape. And so that's a quick way to secure things. And it just makes you feel secure, too, to live there like that.
So did the boarding of your windows and lack of landscaping say something about how you wanted your neighbors to view you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even before that, it said a lot about how I wanted people to view me.
How did you want them to view you?
View me as just as crazy as they are. Does that make sense? Just as crazy as they are, and that's it, really, and just secure myself, you know, for safety.
Did boarding up the windows add that sense of security, or did you wish there was something more?
What, more security than that?
Yeah. Did you feel like you needed anything more than that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Dogs and weapons, and also on the inside of the house, put, rigged up stuff to metal bar that goes across the door, click, click, just like that. Had the doors barred in, too. Yeah.
Wow. So you moved into the area around 1986, 87. Mm-hmm. What's something that was unexpected that happened when you moved in?
Unexpected. Oh, Lord. I can't think of anything unexpected.
Or a story that sticks out in your mind when you first moved in?
Just the craziness, you know, just people wandering everywhere and, you know, just not very good sights to see. But really, there's nothing really unexpected. I probably built myself up a little bit too much, you know, on what I did expect. I expected the worst, you know, so.
So what sort of things did you expect that didn't happen then?
Nothing, because everything I expected to happen probably did, and did. I do have lots of stories, so.
Do you have any in particular you'd like to share?
No, okay. I mean, not that I can think of.
Okay. So last time we talked, you also stated that Pleasant Run was kind of scary when you first moved in. Mm-hmm. It's not a nice area. Now that this many years later, is it still scary?
It began to change around 2010. So it's not as scary, no.
Okay, what kind of things changed?
I think our neighborhood association helped a little bit of the fear going down, because we joined together a few neighbors, you know, to try to make a difference, you know. So with a lot of the projects that we did, or beautification or planting stuff, more people began to come out, you know, so it felt better because there were more people, normal activity going on, and you just felt better. It's actually really the first time I really could take a nice walk around was around 2010.
So how do you think about Pleasant Run, the creek itself now? Because you said before there were a lot of problems, the overgrowth and animals and that sort of
right.
thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How do you think about it now?
It's still pretty overgrown in our area. They're going to probably keep it for last, but I think we're going to start working on that, like the invasive species and things like that. It's a lot less populated around me of, you know, renters and things, the turnover, so, you know, the animals have definitely cut down tremendous amount since 2010. Now, it was still smelling and things. We had lots of problems up until the Super Bowl with the smells. It, you know, a lot of that, even when the plant was running, Coke plant, you know, it would still continue to be bad up in, even though supposedly it closed down in 2007, but it still continues to be bad all the way up, you know, 2012. But, you know, now it does seem that the smells are not as bad.
What sort of things did the Super Bowl change in the area then?
A lot of the landscaping up in Fountain Square, you know, on the east-west side of state, a lot of the landscaping. All the projects that were unfinished became finished when everybody was busy running around. And like the, you know, the plant had shut down, so there wasn't that horrible smell through everything. And then the transfer of the water and the sewer over to Citizens Gas. So energy, there began to be some little projects. And then with our neighborhood association really advocating for things to be changed, slowly, you know, sewer covers are being put on properly that didn't even exist, you know, and massive amount of big stretch of Pleasant Run, you know, and things like that. And so they're doing lots of infrastructure work, lots. And we can also, with the infrastructure, we advocated for lots of sidewalks and prioritize things like that for people in wheelchairs. And so we've really gotten walkability and the handicap accessible. We even did surveys with AARP, got jumped on the board of that, and done surveys in our neighborhood around for all the accessibility. So I figured we really got updated real fast before the Super Bowl.
Wow.
Yeah.
With that big of a change, do you get the sense that a cleaner and safer Pleasant Run is helping revitalize your neighborhood?
I think these efforts have started it to revive the neighborhood.
Which efforts?
All the efforts I was talking about, all the infrastructure, okay. every anything being done now that hasn't even been touched, you know, in 40 years or whatever, is definitely making a difference. And getting all the abandoned houses down and, you know, like that.
So you keep mentioning the WeCan Neighborhood Association. Yes. So let's go ahead and switch gears a little okay. bit. What were some of the challenges you faced in actually creating a new group for the neighborhood?
Well, the first thing is retaliation, is that's the most thing to fear on everyone's mind, that you're going to get pointed your finger at anything and everything that happens that goes on. It's going to be your fault because you're the neighborhood. You're the nosy people that just, you know. So, you know, retaliation was pretty big. And then the challenges we had was just basically simple, you know, trash, weeds, poison ivy, prostitutes. open air drug trafficking, and just, you know, that's who kind of ruled the streets. So you had a challenge to go out there and take the streets back, your neighborhood back.
So how did you deal with problems like those who, for retaliation, or those who were skeptical? How did you try to show them that you were trying to do the best for the neighborhood?
Well, first we had to convince ourselves and get over that hump before we could convince anybody else. But it's just really just talking with them, and, you know, on their own territory, on their own turf, and on their own territory, and just giving people faith and hope, you know, because if they see you, they're more apt to come out too. Some of them did start opening their doors, and that's exactly how we got some people to open their doors. Because even on my streets, heck, a lot of people that just barricade themselves in and don't want anything to do with anybody else. And so a nonprofit group that decided that just run into to help us, you know, what do you need? They asked me as a neighborhood, and I said, well, you know, if we could just get some people out. You know, we need them to, you know, open their door and say, you know, what's going on? I said, even just, you know, help us clean the gutters out or edge the sidewalk, get something, do something, you know. And so they did, and it was Global Peace Initiatives. It's some kind of youth where they come from all over, and they do youth works, group works, or something like that, youth works. And so they did, and a lady, you know, she brought McDonald's to my street every morning. She wasn't even from here, another state, you know. She brought McDonald's, and she would knock on people's door, you know. And then by, you know, a couple days of that, people began to come out and wait for her to bring that McDonald's sandwiches. And, you know, it's like, wow, you know. And so that actually got some more people on our street to actually come out. And then, you know, what's going on, and, you know, stuff like that. So it was actually being neighborly that this lady that had no idea who she was knocking on their door, giving them sandwiches.
So what kind of things did the Global Peace Initiative help you with? So you said cleaning gutters.
Yeah, cleaning gutters, things like that, just simple things just to start, you know, bonding or getting people out and just start to socialize and talk and, you know, to get things started. You know, cleaning gutters, basically offered them if they wanted a free gutter cleaning job, you know, to clean out their gutters and just little stuff like that. But then some major stuff too, hauling, cleaning alleys and all the garbage and all that. Done some major gross stuff.
How?
Planted a few sunflowers, you know. That's about as far as we could get at first.
So, since you've been doing this for so long, what would you say WeCan's biggest accomplishment would be?
Biggest accomplishment was to help get the two blocks of St. Paul Street ready, 11 and 1200 St. Paul, because I still look at it as a hostile street. And they're like, well, you know, we want you to be the model block, and this is SIN, the Southeast Side Neighborhood Development, so we won a little award. And then was told that they wanted us to be like the model area for 2010. And there was this legacy build, which SIN had got handed from Fuller. So Fuller said, okay, Southeast Neighborhood Development, you got it. Now you got to find the place where we can build 10 homes in one street. And that's not easy to do. But on St. Paul, it was very easy to do. There was three homeowners and then a few renters, a few squatters. So basically it was easier to do, but it was still hostile and still kind of controlled by the same family at that point. For the last like 15 years, it was controlled by the same one family that was on those two blocks. And so I thought, well, I had to ask God for help. Because I wasn't about ready to, you know, challenge these. These were actually my neighbors to the back. So I know who they are, you know. But it just worked out to where they just outgrew their house, you know. They got real behind and they couldn't make payments and blah, blah, blah. And they stripped their own house and gone after 15 years. But we also did, prior to that, with the Fuller Center, we had 100 people go down that street. And the Fuller Center sang, "Oh, when the saints come marching in," from one end to the next, two blocks long. And there was one group that was renting, and they were the little gangbangers and all, and just peddly selling drugs and just causing trouble. And they moved within like about 8 days after the Fuller Center and us walked down the street. They moved, but it took a little bit longer for the other family that was a homeowner. And so that's the stuff we kind of did, just, you know, just trying to work really hard. Went after, you know, I went to some leadership classes and learned how to try to, you know, organize, you know, things and get it to come together. Done a lot of cleaning, a lot of preparing, you know, tried to get things cleaned as best as we could. And the houses, you know, went to try to get them so they could acquire them, you know, send. So we had to, us as a neighborhood association, had we done a lot of work, you know, behind the scenes, I would say. You know, turning things in, challenging people, you know. And there was a guy straight behind me. He was a veteran. And he rented a little tiny double back straight behind me. And he was not all there, you know. He was real secluded in, one of those type of people. And he liked it more or less on the emptiness of the street, because then he could stay in his thing. But he was from, you know, Vietnam, so he was very, war-minded and stuff. He would do, and I don't even want to say what we tried to do to get to straighten out the criminals. You know, but you had to, because he was broken into or hassled. They hassled him. They started hassling, too. Nails under the tires, that's a retaliation type thing, you know, BBs and things like that, you know. And but he helped, there was a few that helped him like that, where, you know, he would, and the crime was go away, you know. But he might have done a couple tactics, you know, like, I hate to say all my stuff, but you know, you got to do what you got to do when you're fighting that. You can't always have the police on your side, you know. So you have to take things in your own hands. But it worked. And So we helped really them quite a lot get the, and then they did their thing, and we had a legacy build for the Fuller Center where, you know, it's now got 10 brand new homes on it. They done like 16 other homes throughout our neighborhood the same week, and it was just like a extreme makeover, you know, which helped quite a lot. Because they turned a street that wasn't bringing no tax dollars in, really, nothing, and hadn't been, just spending money on emergency vehicles for the last 15 years, you know. But it brought it to positive to, you know, now they're paying taxes, got nicer new homes on there, and stuff like that, you know.
So with everything that you guys have accomplished so far, what do you think the next big project you guys want to take on is?
Okay, I just went there yesterday. It's trying to get in on an initiative called Great Places 2020. So they're sending out their beginning of two, it's not like a grant, but it's just basically designating, you know, a couple areas that, you know, will be on its way or be great places by 2020. And there's a lot of criteria, I should say, to be able to meet, to be those two choices from LISC. And I know LISC is in it, but I don't know who else. And a local support corporation, something like that. But so we hoped, I hope to help influence that around the road destination, Prospect Falls, and the Citizens Cove property and the old Twin Air drive-in property. You know, so I'm hoping to push them into that being the great place this 2020.
So what is it that you want to happen at Prospect Falls?
For more eyes to be on it and more people, because to open it, you know, have more eyes on it and educate more people and come there as a destination place to where they can, you know, look uphill at what was the Coke plant. And then hope in the future when, with the Kessler plant and all that, which I was just floored that, you know, they go up and around the Coke plant. Oops, let's not even include that, you know, and skip right on over it. Well, I was disappointed at seeing a lot of that, skipping over, you know, which it is. But hopefully that connection right there in between where the creek goes straightly through that someday the bike path, the Pleasant Run Trail, well, and it's not, that's just not my vision. A lot of people in the Southeast, people I never even knew, cared about reconnecting that trail there through its, the way it should be, through the plant. So, like, I guess this can be a gateway or something like that, or just a destination spot where in the future we'll see what happens with the rest, you know, the connectivity in the creek.
Perfect. Well, at this time, I'm going to hand it over to Elena to do the next section.
Okay, thanks. So you've talked a lot about some of the organizations you've collaborated with, like Row, Reconnecting to Our Waterways, or SEND, the Southeast Neighborhood Development.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other organizations that you've worked closely with?
Well, there was a GINI, the Greater Indianapolis Neighborhood Incentive, and that we worked with them with that. The Southeast Community Services Center, 901 Shelby, has helped a lot. And the Annie Casey Foundation,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So I guess I'll start with the first one you mentioned.
Okay.
Can you talk more about the Great Neighborhood Initiative and what you did with them?
Okay, I had no idea. I just jumped in, you know, with my feet and didn't have not a clue what I was doing or anything or where I was at. But there's a quality of life plan. They developed a quality of life plan for the Southeast. So it was already underway when I started attending. It took a few years for them to complete that. I don't know if it was 4 or 5 years or 4 years, something like that. And so I got in on about half of it, so I was able to kind of be there at the beginning. I was there through half the quality of life plan, creating it. And I know that Jenny did that. There were some small grants that they would allow for the neighborhoods to do just to, for the community, just to start building the community, whether it's just to have a little neighborhood picnic or something, just something to start a community. So that's what we did too. Got a little grant, you know, to help buy supplies, you know, the stuff you need, tents, chairs, tables, stuff like that, t-shirts so you can be recognized.
And that was for organizing?
Yeah, yeah. So we that's what we use for the Jenny. We got a lot of stuff to start, you know, organizing and mm-hmm. starting our group and everything.
And where has that gone today? I guess it's still underway with the plan?
Jenny? Mm-hmm. It went out. It only had so far a lifespan, okay. I guess. And so there's nothing in that anymore. And I don't know really where it leads to from that, except, you know, we have a Southeast Congress, so now we can have a little Congress and go there 4 times a year. We have a neighborhood Congress.
And that has several of the different neighborhood organizations.
Usually it's a few of the leaders, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of the leaders, maybe the city, county council. We had 3 there the last time. That's pretty good, you know. And I gave them heck. I don't know if they'll be back. No, I'm just kidding. No, they do. They do. And we celebrate, too, you know, during the Congress. Celebrate a lot of the stuff that's been done. A lot of stuff. Like, I don't really doubt that $8 or $9 million has been spent in my neighborhood. That's a lot. And I'm not talking the whole Southeast or nothing, just in my neighborhood, my area. That's amazing. You know.
And where has that money been going toward?
Streets and sidewalks, mm-hmm. the trail, a lot of weatherization too. We had at that time, that, you know, things lead into that model block in 2010. They also secured, I don't even know who they is. I'm using Send a lot, you know, because they were our sponsor, more or less, or, you know, so our anchor, that's all I know. So weatherization too in our neighborhood. Citizens Energy put up, like, you know, $200,000 during this time for us just to get houses weatherized in our neighborhood. Yeah, unbelievable. You know, and we did. Lots of people got the foam spray, got, you know, things, plastic laid out underneath their houses, which I'm sure helps with the gases that come up, you know, out of the ground. Because I think it smells and it comes out of a lot of ground around there, smells. Our heat bills went in half, cut in half.
And besides the bike trail, did more go to Pleasant Run and that?
The creek itself, I'm not taking any, not mm-hmm. anything except for the sewer covers, which they've just really recently started doing that, so I wouldn't even include that in that. I don't think much of that went, because Citizens Energy didn't even want to take responsibility for the creek at all. You know, just now are they starting to take response, you know, mm-hmm. saying, oh.
Yeah. I think we're going to talk more about that a little later, because that is definitely important.
Okay. Yes, nothing was done that I know of.
Okay. But getting back to some organizations, you also mentioned the Annie Casey Foundation today, and they started their Making Connections initiative around 1997. Mm-hmm. And what sort of things did they do with We Can, or how did you first
honestly, I mean, I didn't know it. Most of the efforts, I believe, was concentrated on the west side of state.
Okay.
And so I'm on the east side. So I really didn't even know it until 2000 and, you know, well, I really didn't even know 2008. You know, but it became to light where I knew everything by 2009, more about Annie Casey. Now, I didn't know they were in the neighborhood doing a lot what they were doing until it was coming towards the end of their initiative, you know.
And what do you think they've accomplished in the whole Southeast area?
Well, I think they did, they accomplished a lot that what I see they did was strengthen, and you know, their target was to strengthen, to better for kids in tough neighborhoods, growing up in tough neighborhoods, to give them a better shot and a better chance. And but you have to help the neighborhood, you have to help the families in order to get to the children. So, so that's what they did. You know, a lot of education. You know, a lot of things. You know.
Another thing that your own organization offers are resources for your neighbors. And so I was wondering if you could explain a bit more about what types of resources you offer.
Well, resources is just basically the, I say just the avenues in order to get things done. Mm-hmm. Or like the, if you can lead them to a foundation or help or 901 Shelby or anything, you know, any of their questions, or sometimes they don't know, you know, how to make their street better, their block, and the different programs like Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, trying to get more people hooked up with stuff like that, smooth out relationships between, you know, like the IMPD and animal control, and, you know, just try and also bring resources like that in too. You know, we called and, you know, asked for help. You know, we don't want you to come in with guns out, we want help, you know. And we don't want you to come in and attack these people, come in and help a few of these people because they've already been attacked for the last 15 years. Now it's time to come in and help. And so bring resources like that. Try to find out who's helping animals, who's helping people, and then try to lead them to the right places. Or join them if need be to get something done. We could team up with them to help them get something done on their street. In which we did that, we've done that too, plenty, too. It might take them, and then reality, help them realize that it might take a couple years, you know, to do it. And get them, you know, support them, the residents during that time, not to give up, you know. And that's it, I think.
So I also want to turn topic slightly to environmental justice.
Yes.
And for the sake of listeners who might not be familiar with the term environmental justice, I'm going to insert a working definition into the record. Environmental justice is defined by the Environmental Protection Agency as, quote, the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. It will be achieved when everyone enjoys the same degree of protection from environmental and health hazards and equal access to the decision-making process to have a healthy environment in which to live, learn, and work. So, when did you first become aware of the idea of environmental justice around? Or how?
For like my neighborhood and things?
Yeah, we can talk about Pleasant Run if there was...
Well, I really, like before that, you know, just felt that everything was just, you know, I didn't have, you know, we didn't have a chance. You know, there's too many of them and not enough of us or something, you know, and it's hard to fight big entities and things like that. But really around... I was really into it when we first started. I've been waiting for this, you know, too. I knew someday, I was hoping someday that I would be able to be a part of the, of any kind of justice or remediation in the Southeast side. So I was kind of really ready. I started really taking pictures and doing things in 208, right when we started, you know, around Pleasant Run Creek and things. Because I knew it was time. And plus, too, you know, I mean, I don't know. We just didn't have a lot of camera, you know. I had beepers up until 19, I don't know when, but, you know. So it's not just as easy, and it became easier to get the camera and get things and go out there. And I was really on a mission. So I would say from 2008, and then each time it's gotten more and more to 2012, I was really into it, you know.
Yeah, and when you think of Pleasant Run, like, what sort of things did you notice that really concerned you when you talk about
it? Well, it always concerned about what was being dumped into it or seeping into it, running into it, anything. Mm-hmm. It always concerned me, you know, mm-hmm. always.
Yeah, and has there really been anyone working from this, well, besides you, have other people in your neighborhood been aware of environmental justice issues?
I would say quite a lot, no. I mean, I think they were, but it's just divided. It's nothing. So the more people are divided, the more there's, you know, so not that I was aware of. You know, I am aware now that other people, top people that might have, you know, I didn't know what the Hoosier Environmental Council was, didn't know about that, you know, didn't know anything, you know. So I don't really know of, I believe maybe I was the first one who really come up with the neighbors. Unless they were in somewhere else, I just didn't know it, you know.
Yeah, and how did you first become aware of the actual concept of environmental justice? Because it sounds like you definitely knew about, you had seen what was going on and felt a sense of inequality, but was it?
Right, but whether you could do anything about it, I didn't think there was just, you know, it was just too overpowering. I just, you know, I felt like they just really, in order to get away with stuff that, you know, was to me being gotten away with, and being ignored and everything. Mm-hmm. I just knew politically there was just too much, somebody had too much power, you know, to be doing what they were doing.
Anyone in particular?
Well, I don't want to point fingers, you know, because there is several industrial places and there's a long history of some things. So, but majorly, it's a coke plant, yeah. And plus two, until probably 2010 or 11, 12, I didn't realize how many or know how many combined sewer overflows was on Pleasant Run. But that was a lot of what I used from the 2008 on, and I'll still use it, but I had to find out a lot of that information so that I could use that to advocate for better environment and better, you know, things for the people and the land and, you know, our area, the whole thing, you know. So I had to start learning about all that and then start pressing it, like, you know, go places and say, yeah, but what about, you know, and start really, but we are the, you know, and all that, start advocating, yeah.
Yeah, and when you first moved into your neighborhood with Mayor Hudnut, do you think that he and the city government were aware of any of the problems?
Yes, I
Pleasant
do.
Run?
I really do. I think everybody's been aware for a long time, you know. I really do.
And did they, were there any tasks done to address them?
Not that I'm aware of, except for turning your back.
Okay. And how have things changed?
Well, definitely the internet and the all that. You know, just the knowledge and the information that can be in the you know, the internet, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's changed quite a lot. You know, they can't hide behind things anymore, mm-hmm. you know. A lot more eyes on it. Yeah, I think the internet helped. Our information, technology, that's it, and stuff. Like that.
And how do you mainly use the internet then for finding out information about
I use everything. Yeah, Google everything. Mm-hmm. Anything you want to know. And just research. I love that, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot out there.
Yeah, and then there's a lot to go through and you gotta see what's credible and everything. But a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the combined sewers.
Mm-hmm.
So have you noticed lots of sewage overflow in Pleasant Run?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. At St. Paul and Pleasant Run North Drive is probably the worst smelling. And I don't know why, but yeah, and a lot of the neighbors, you know, because we're all within half, you know, not very far from the Pleasant Run. So when it does or would fill up, flood or whatever, fill up quite a lot. Now I understand it without covers on them too, that it's easier to backflow, that water backflows up and causes things. So, but there was no sewer covers between Sherman Drive, you know, on down towards State. Absolutely no covers. You know, we went by and took pictures of all of them.
And what have you done with those photos?
Well, a lot of them I tried to get them to people that higher up that could maybe get mm-hmm. something done. You know, yeah. I don't know if you know Richard Van Frank or not. Do you know Richard Van Frank, anybody?
Not personally, but I saw him speaking about the the Deep Rock Tunnel.
Did you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was with, like, I don't know. He cares about kids. Of course, a lot of people do, you know. He was like a scientist at Lilly's and stuff and retired and everything. He's really an activist. And, you know, that's, I don't know. I was just led to, if I could get him some pictures. He's up at all the clean water things and meetings and committees and all that to where he could, you know. And that's it. I made a presentation. I showed it to the Southeast Congress. I have a link, you know, where people can go view it, you know, to see some of the pictures I've taken. And try to do what you're supposed to do. Send them to the your congressman or whatever. I've done that. Yeah.
So how do you think change will come?
Change is only going to come if people's made to change, mm-hmm. you know, and things come out to light. But there has to be work done, mm-hmm. you know. There has to be work done, and they know big corporations have a lot of monies and a lot of lawyers on retainers. They know how to bury you with papers this stack this full, you know, for IDEM to go through or something. You know, here's our paperwork. 5,000 pieces of paper that nobody wants to go through. You know, it's just little tactics and strategies that corporations use to try to get out of things or get around things. Mm-hmm. You know, so change is going to come when those papers are read, those files are read, and they're held accountable.
Mm-hmm. Finally, I just wanted to mention the Deep Rock Tunnel mm-hmm. for listeners in the future. This connector is being constructed by Citizens Energy Group to store 250 million gallons of sewage, and the goal is to reduce sewage overflow from Indianapolis's current combined sewer system. Mm-hmm. And we've been told that your area will be one of the last to be connected to the tunnel. But what do you think this project will mean to the neighborhood?
Well, the neighborhood was not really happy to hear that they were mm-hmm. going to be last again, yeah. you know, which is, I understand that, you know. But the feelings from the group and people was that they don't want to be last. They're going to start doing niche things now, you know, whether or force or see if they can try to force to speed up something or do anything within this 15 years to make it better while waiting, you know.
And are they working with any particular organizations, or are you
pursuing? Like for the Deep Rock Tunnel and all?
Yeah.
Well, they have other, Citizens Energy has the community meetings, you know, every so mm-hmm. often, part of their voluntary remediation program to comply, they have to have community meetings. So they keep us updated, mm-hmm. you know, and that's it. That's all we can be, is keep updated, you know. But we've went after the road destination, went after quite a lot to get stuff started there now, you know, as far as, and so we'll be starting invasive, you know, try to get invasive species removal. And I learned a whole new meaning for that word. I get it now. It's everything. It could mean something different to other different people, invasive species. you know, we had to do some of that. Removing.
Yeah, but
things like that, you know, to get it, to, like the Lilies Day of Service and things. Mm-hmm. We also was right there pushing my way right in to get right in on, you know, tree planting and everything, mm-hmm. getting us included. Well, we're going to be the model block. We need to be included in that Lily Days of Service, you know. So we have, you know.
Mm-hmm. And they're just down there along Pleasant Run?
Yeah, 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 from state to all the way to the gas company. Not a lot of tree planting yet towards the gas company, but we'll get to that. It's going to start this, we're going to start this fall, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I'm going to now turn it over to Lynette.
Oh, we're gonna get down and dirty.
More about the coke plant.
All right.
So the coke plant has been mentioned several times. It's obviously a big impact on the area.
Yes.
For those who don't know, Citizens Gas and Coke Utility, now known as Citizens Energy, formed in 1906, and then 3 years later in 1909, it built the Public Charitable Trust Utility, opened Indianapolis Coke in the southeast portion of Center Township, mm-hmm. which is on the eastern edge of your neighborhood along Pleasant Run.
Mm-hmm.
The roughly 140-acre site was used by the gas company until its closure in 2007 to create coke and its byproducts, manufactured gas and tar. In so doing, it piped gas throughout the city, but also discharged pollution into Pleasant Run and chemical fumes into the surrounding air. In recent years, Citizens Energy has faced considerable pressure from federal and state laws and community pressure to clean up the toxic brownfield left behind by nearly a century of operation. According to the Coke Plant Reuse Project Group's preliminary report of March 2009, the connection between Citizens Gas and Coke Utility, the neighborhood it occupies, and the surrounding geographic region appears to have been a love-hate relationship. When you consider your own neighborhood, would you consider the relationship with Citizens Energy to be love or hate?
Well, hate and love. Let's put it that way. We'll put hate first and love next.
Okay, and can you explain why that is? Why is hate the most dominant?
Hate's the most dominant because of the damage that's been done. Yes, definitely the damage that's been done. You know, to see the effects on the people and the land, you know, the water, you know.
So what have they done to earn your love?
Really just like a landmark, you know, and because, you know, it's still gonna stick with me. You know, you're driving home, you might be on the other side of town, but you could see this big cloud that hovered over your neighborhood. And each time I hope that's not my house on fire. Each time coming in, you're kind of worried, but it's like a landmark, you know, and just say, well, there's my neighborhood, and you can see it all the way from Hendricks County, you know, way out, you know, on the surrounding counties, you can see where your neighborhood's at from the cloud of smoke.
Okay, so that drew your attention and made it a landmark because you were near to it.
Yeah.
But that the Coke Plant Reuse Project Group's report also points out that many residents of the city, if they thought about the plant at all, were most likely unconcerned and happy to have a cheap source of gas to light their streets and heat their businesses and homes. Unlike most of the rest of the city, you're right next to the coke plant.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you react when you realized that while other parts of the city got cheap gas, your neighborhood had to live with the environmental problems associated with producing that gas?
Yeah, that's part of the hate, too. And I don't see where the cheap gas was really that cheap, you know. The house I live in now, it's big square footage, but that's one of the things. You know, people couldn't heat their homes around there. The people couldn't. There's a lot of people that struggled, very much struggled paying gas bills, paying their own utility gas bills. You know, so mine was like $800 a month in 1986. Now, who could pay that? So I don't see the cheap gas. I don't know where that came. Because it was always been very expensive, you know. And a lot of people would constantly struggle in my neighborhood with paying their own, keeping utilities on. Yeah, and so that's definitely a big hate, because I believe that to be a lie, not the truth.
Yeah. So what concerns did you have about the plant being so near you when you first moved to the area?
Fire and explosions. There were several explosions.
So when did you realize what it was and how it was impacting the neighborhood?
Well, the 90s were pretty hopping during the 90s were pretty hopping in the early 2000s. It was just the whole neighborhood just keeping busy with crime and you know, it's horrible to say that though, you know, just disorder, you know, so that really keeps a big amount of people occupied, disorder. Because that's all that's going on, you know. I always knew it, but at the same time, I really didn't have nothing else to do or nowhere to go. You know, if you have a house or something, and you can't just, nobody's buying nothing, so it's not like just sell and leave, you know. What else better do I have? I have nothing, you know. Nowhere to go, nothing better to do. I have to stay here too, you know. So, but you knew something was, it's not right. And then it became to be so bad at the end of 99, or the 90s, until it closed. I mean, it was tremendously, chemicals that I had never even smelled from being there before. So it wasn't the same, whatever you're smelling. There was bunches of different stuff that was periodically through.
So with most of the rest of the city not really giving it much thought at all, and most of the people in your neighborhood wrapped up in crime and the disorder, what were the attitudes that you and people around you had toward the coke plant during that time period, closer to your neighborhood? Was it, did more people pay attention to it because they lived near it than in the rest of the city, or was it still ignored even in the neighborhood?
I just don't think it was ignored totally, but it's just you just feel helpless, you know, like when you feel like nobody's on your side. I don't care who it is that works for the city or anybody, nobody's on your side. It's just like everybody's against you. You know, there's no way we could, you knew something was happening, but I just, you know, just didn't call no numbers, didn't know where to call, you know, didn't know anything. I didn't know what a mayor's liaison was till 2008, you know. That's simple, but I mean, it might be simple, but I didn't even know what it was, you know, and that's, a lot of people didn't know, you know. So
many of the people surveyed by the Coke Plant Reuse Project Group claim that they were breathing easier now that the plant was closed. While in operation, what effects did you see that you could attribute to the plant?
Well, I was, before I really contributed at all, before it started adding up throughout the years, we'll go from the 80s, you know, on up, I wasn't too for sure why people in that area were like they were. You know, and I didn't even know what the word Appalachian means. I didn't even know. So I'm sorry, but I didn't know, you know, until after about 2008 before I started realizing, you know. So I didn't know a lot of things, but I knew that there was just a lot of sickness, a lot of asthma. You know, it's like everybody had asthma from children on up. And I know it can have to do with your own lifestyle, but something's different. Something's different about this. You know, more people sick with asthma. You know, a lot of asthma, a lot of breathing problems. and disabilities. Lots of speech problems, speech that impediments and things. I knew that there wasn't, you know, very low education, you know, all of it. So I began to say that, you know, this, and of course with all what you deal with, because even living there, everything's black. You know, all the water's black, so your house is black. Everything, so it takes you a while, you know, to get walks put down and clean, get things clean, and, you know. So you just knew something was going on, but didn't quite put it all together until a little bit later. And you just know it can't be right.
So you mentioned, you said that your home was black.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a few reports that indicate that there was a recurring problem with the fumes from the plant discoloring
mm-hmm.
houses,
mm-hmm.
Turning them purple in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any discoloration on your house?
It was always sooty, so black soot's everywhere, on your cars. You can wake up in the morning, even if you cleaned it the night before. You had black soot on the house, everywhere, so you just sprayed it off with the hose. And now we also had in 1990, I can remember things that didn't add up. White stuff also, one morning, woke up in the late 90s, whether it be 98, 99. And there was white stuff all over the car. Everywhere, not just the car, everywhere. And I even called my neighbors back then and asked them, do you have stuff all over your car too? But if I knowed back then, you know, I would have got some samples of that and I would have kept that. But I didn't really, and that really bites. I really wish I would have, you know, been, wish you could see the future, you know. But yes, soot everywhere. And even after the plant closed, with a lot of the demolition going on and everything they're doing over there, we have bouts with that too, you know. And brown, so if it, you know, if it's not rained for a while and they do something over there, the gas tank holder, first time it rained, it was the ungodliest fumes come down my road I've ever smelled, you know. And it was came with the runoff, the runoff, and it was brown, chocolate brown. Yeah, it stunk really bad, the stormwater.
Have you noticed any negative changes since the closing of the plant?
Negative changes? Yes, with the demolition. The lack of, I don't know if regulations or being regulated, or the lack of its magnitude of what it is, what it was, to its cleanup. You know, it's not just a tiny little gas station that used to be there. It's a big, massive, very big, massive 100 years, and it needs to be treated that way. But the gas holder, when it came down, you know, like the health department was not even there on grounds, IDEM was not even on grounds. They were just allowed to hire some company from Illinois, and they very stupidly did it in the middle of the drought in July. Very hot, very droughty, and it was horrible. It was absolutely, and then a few of my neighbors that had been battling sickness for a long time, mainly like brain tumors, breathing problems, all kinds of stuff like that, and then their own, you know, you bring some upon yourself, that's fine, you know, but it's like they didn't make it through the drought and that smell of that tank coming down and all what they did during that time. That was horrible. And I really do believe that put a few of my neighbors into the bed and they never got out. And it made me sick too. And this was in, they just got done doing it not too long ago, 2012. And I complained. And I called the mayor's action line and was told that they were not taking complaints about citizens and that you would have to, that I would have to call citizens myself. And that made me really upset. So I complained about that I couldn't complain.
So how did you follow that up? Did you call citizens and complain to them?
No, I did not. I called, I still complained of that, and then the newspaper. Indy Star. Okay. So we got it on the front page
so
of Indy
Star. So it made
Star.
The front page of Indy
Star. Yeah. And then is when the health department decided to bring out their little meters to read the air quality after it was over, after they were done.
So in our previous conversations, you had mentioned that you think that the Coke plant was responsible for the destruction of Prospect Falls.
Yes.
What makes you believe that they're responsible for that?
I believe so because of the, I think that a lot of the bacteria that's growing around, I don't know, I'm not a scientist, okay, but I know it eats it the way it stuff and other stuff, and Prospect Falls was held together with rebarb metal, gigantic, you know, about an inch thick staples. And it was just like, what could have slowly, you know, take 20 years to do or whatever, it just overnight, you know, it just seemed like a lot of those metal just disintegrated, you know. I think it's chemicals or bacteria, you know, ate away at a lot of the metal. That's my theory, though, that it helped. And I believe CSX also did it, the railroad. CSX, they removed big chunks of it to repath the water to go down the center because half of the bridge was falling down. And I know they knew it, too, from bridge inspections, but I did complain quite a lot that something needed to be done, you know. Well, I believe citizens let out a lot of stuff in the last few years. Even prior, I believe it goes back to, I know, and when I really noticed was around 204. And around 204, like I said, there were stuff and smells and just like some things there for 20 minutes and then gone. So I know they were leading up to closing, probably, and I feel like they were emptying stuff or letting stuff out. Some more stuff was being dumped. And I believe it all rushed, all that together combination, CSX and citizens, destroyed the rest of it.
So it's been noted that children liked to play in the in the polluted falls area, and some people even fish in Pleasant Ridge.
Absolutely.
Do you feel that that's safe to do?
No, no.
And how do people use the area for recreation now?
You can still go down there, and children will still be playing in the water, you know. And we've taken a group down there to look at the falls and things like that of some bigger people, you know, in organizations and stuff. To even Jan Diggins, a community outreach person for citizens, and we all walk down there, and you know, there's four or five kids in the water, you know.
So how would you say that use of the waterway has been improved or diminished?
But a lot of the people that even grew up there using it are well aware now, you know, just from talk and just from, they have updated the signage along the river too. I forgot to mention that they did update the signage saying that it's polluted, and so that has helped a lot of people. A little bit too late, some of them. It's too late, but they might not go waiting like they did before. Yeah.
Okay. So thinking about the Coke plant site, the 140 acres,
mm-hmm.
Citizens Energy put forth a proposed reuse vision mm-hmm. in April of 2009, and they said that with citizens' leadership, community involvement, and willing partners, we believe the Prospect Street site can be reused in ways consistent with this vision of balanced redevelopment, promoting substantial job creation, and community revitalization. So how has Citizens Energy shown leadership in the neighborhoods affected by the abandoned Coke facility?
How have they showed leadership? Oh, God. Not very well, I don't think. um, I mean, they say they are and things, but they're just doing and getting, you know, as much as they until the neighbors, you know, come up. And it's like now they're taking a different turn now than they did a few months back because of the different people that show up at their community meetings and the involvement of different things. God, I don't know. I don't really believe that quite a lot because what they showed first, you know, they want to say that, but they first tried to sell the whole thing for $1 and nobody buy it, you know, so, or whatever, you know, nobody's going to buy it. And then they want to make it all really heavy. They wanted, well, they tried to sell it for a coke plant. You know, and then they was telling us, oh, it can only be heavy industrial that goes back there, you know, or else we'll just put a cement over all of it, just cap it all off. That's what they, you know. So as far as what we, my stage of being involved with citizens, you know, that what that says was not what we was being told. We was being told, you know, no way it's going to be clean. You know, it's just going to be cleaned up to heavy industrial, and that's what's going to go back into it. You know, but nobody, that don't make no sense because nobody, I don't think, wants to, has that like heavy industrial like that anymore. I don't know. I don't know who would buy it for, I don't know. But I don't see the job creation. I don't see, you know. I just don't see that, you know.
So the Citizens Energy's highest and best use study did find that industrial to a heavy, light to a heavy industrial had the highest market demand for the property, and they plan to sell a majority of the property to this type of development.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think that more industry to replace the coke plant will impact the neighborhoods?
More industry? Light, you know, I think it's a negative impact. It's going to be because it's negative, you know. That's just not what I gather, that's not what's happening. You know, it's mostly mixed use that's going to sell, is mixed use land, and to where they could put some just commercial, maybe light industrial, office or warehouse type stuff, you know. But I see that making more money and be better for the neighborhood, mixed use. And other people do, younger people that, you know, are college educated and things who have started to come to the community meetings, you know, their voice and their opinions. That's where I'm learning that, you know.
So in that same report, they stated that they were committed to a systematic demolition of the coke production structures, remediation of environmental impacts, actively soliciting public and private funding sources for site reuse, marketing the property, and providing ongoing communication with community stakeholders. How much communication has occurred between Citizens Energy and local neighborhood groups?
As least as possible. Yep, as least as possible. And they have a community outreach person who has worked for a very long time with them, and she does a good job at quieting people down. Or if all else fails, they offer them a job. So I guess, you know, they're not doing their part, I don't think. They're doing their part the opposite, I think, just to quiet people down, calm them down, and to not be involved. And they don't answer our questions, you know.
So Citizens Energy's reuse proposal does list green space and recreation and community-sensitive projects near the most heavily populated areas, specifically the Twin Air Drive-In
mm-hmm.
property. So how do people in your neighborhood feel about this proposal?
Mm. Well, the people in my neighborhood view it as they didn't talk with us. They talked with another community leader who has been there in the neighborhood for 30 years.
She's in that magazine.
And she's in the magazine, Rachel Cooper, the Southeast Community Organization. And she was like the voice. And she was the one. They tried to gather some information on what the neighborhood wanted and things like that, but to me, they already had their minds made up. So it's like asking, we just didn't really feel like we was a part. And it does, and it still don't make no sense to me. You know, rugby or baseball or anything right next to that's not cleaned up and messy, and you know, the shopping is not great around that area. It can be better. There's definitely spaces for economic growth, you know. But in other words, to us, it seemed like just something just to appease the, you know, people. Let's just say this, you know.
So what activities would you like to see in that community space?
Well, it would be nice to have a true assessment of what the neighborhood needs. A true assessment. Whether it's, a small medical facility, or, you know, just something too that's going to actually bring people and to spur, you know, growth through that area.
Okay, so before the wrap up, I'm gonna ask a hypothetical. Picture 10 years from now, what does your neighborhood look like?
Well, 10 years from now, the water bill will be clean right there, and it will be a real pretty area to come, Prospect Falls. And there will also be a trail through the gas company property, the Coke plant property, that connects the waterways. And let's see, it would be really neat to have stuff that maybe not, don't exist very many places in the United States. I don't know, you know, whatever it may be, you know, along the, because I also know that there's flood area. It's flood area in there. And I'm learning too, you just can't, you know, build things on flood area. So there's a lot of issues there. And since it is a flood zone through the Coke plant in some places, that will have to be green space, because they can't build on it. So that'll be really neat. And even if you don't touch the water or whatever, even if you could just go by it or go up and over it, or I seen a bicycle roundabout, you know, or something, you know, even a museum, you know, in the buildings, because that's that love-hate relationship, that even though, you know, all the bad and stuff, it's still, those buildings are still, you know, landmarks, are still special. You know, you see these wild big contraptions, you used to have smoke all coming out of the corners and alarms going off all the time. And they went off during the night too. They didn't go off during the night, I mean during the day, every once in a while. But at night it was like somebody was paid to hit a button to shut the alarm off. And I guarantee somebody was. That's what they did, because at night, all along, and that would go all night long. And so then I figured it out and read and researched that they would do stuff dirtier at night, and they would do more of their stuff at night that was more harmful and things like that. They would explode stuff up into the, you know, things, all kinds of things that happen at night.
All right, so we're about to finish up. Is there anything that you wished we'd asked and done it?
No, I think you pretty much got it, you know. It's just, there is one thing, too. I don't know what the big pilot light that the Coke company had running at all times. It was a tube up, and then like a pilot light would be pretty big. Well, during the 90s, for some reason, it got extremely huge. And then I remember also going to a meeting sometime back then, or going to some kind of hearing it, or somebody that had went to a meeting or something. I wasn't really involved, but I remember that saying that they were trying to tell us that so many something millions of however they measure burning off, that like 18 million somethings were burning nowadays rather than so many millions, you know. It was just, and they couldn't stop the fire. They couldn't stop it from being that high. And it burned for a long time, really extremely high, to where you could just go along the road next to it or whatever, and you would feel the heat from that. And I don't know what it was. And then, like I say, I was a little bit, you know, you get a little bit, you know, it really does affect you physically bad, you know, mental and everything, all this. So, I mean, I was, you know, you get depressed, you get down, you get like, you know, this is the end of the world, it's hell, you know, and all that. To where I was at a state of mind to where I guess if it's go, you know, I'm going to go really fast, it's going to blow up this whole half of this side of town, you know. So in a sense, you're just depressed, and I guess I'm right at the best spot to be blown completely to smithereens, you know, if something happens. I know, but mentally I can't, you know, you're losing it and stuff. And I became really sick, and those smells during the 2000s. And then I became, you know, it would be so bad, you'd have to shut the door, come back. I don't know how anything lived. I don't really know how anything, I don't know how none of us made it, you know. But I got really to where I passed completely out. I can't see, you know, doubles and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, I had to go start going to the Wisher and all that, started in 2006, but it was working up to it for about the 2 years. I couldn't, you know. So yeah, I became a guinea pig for Wishard Hospital in 2006. that's how I feel. So I'm just gonna have to say what I feel, you know. I believe something was extremely going on around there. Heavy duty.
All right. Is there anything else you think we should know before we close up?
I don't think so.
All right. Thank you very
much. Thank you.
Okay.